This is People's Tribune Radio. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this edition of PTR, we're pleased to have as our guest the award-winning author of Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary, and The Future is Up to Us, Nelson Peary.
So we're talking about a new epic in the development of human beings, without war, without stress, without fear, without hunger. The doors open to the cultural and intellectual development of the entire human race.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper, People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. While being a true old-school revolutionary, Nelson Peary is a man whose ideas and vision for a new America are certainly not mired in the past. He's the author of a number of books, including Moving Onward, Black Fire, and his newest work, The Future is Up to Us. Peary, who's also a founding member of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, was interviewed by Alicia Espinosa in Chicago, Illinois.
This is Alicia Espinosa with People's Tribune Radio in Chicago, Illinois. We're honored today to have as our guest Nelson Peary, author of the award-winning book, Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary, a memoir of his years as a black soldier in World War II. Since then, Nelson Peary has crossed the country meeting with individuals and groups, talking and listening. The result of these journeys is the new book, The Future is Up to Us, a revolutionary talking politics with the American people.
I think that anybody who goes through a war experience, that they learn certain things that stays with them the rest of their life. That my experience in the Army was absolutely invaluable to my life as a revolutionary in the post-war period. And that is, I learned organization. That the struggles of the African-American people have always been struggles that were just like a wave of self-sacrificing, brave people attacking just some kind of a vicious beast, you know, this Jim Crow and segregation. But they never had organization. They were only around some paramount leader. And this leader, you know, directed the operations. And when that leader was either done away with or sold out or whatever, the movement came to an end. I mean, even a very good leader, if you take, for example, the death of Martin Luther King, the work of the civil rights movement was by no way over. But there was such a concentration of power in the hands of a very few people, this little group around Martin Luther King, that when he died, the movement essentially died with him, that there was no organizational structure to carry it on. So what I understood, that if you're going to contribute in a historic sense, that is to say, if your contribution is going to remain, if it's going to be something solid that somebody else can build upon, you have got to master organization. During the tour, the Black Fire tour, at the publication of the book, I came to realize that almost everyone that I spoke to or spoke with understood that we're in an epoch of great changes, of great social and economic changes, but very, very few of them understood what this change was or how they were going to relate to it. So I finished that tour with a understanding, with a feeling, sense, that I should try to write a simply written book, not a dummy-down book, because American people aren't dumb at all, but a simply written book to present a revolutionary perspective to the era that we're in, that are entering. That is this change from an industrial society and all that means to this postmodern world that we're entering. The revolution that we're so used to reading about, the young generation, so used to reading about, really are military or political coups. That is to say, certain groups, you know, just simply seize power, and they don't transform the society. There's a difference between a revolution that ends up with transformation of an entire society and a revolution that simply changes political power from the hands of one group within a class to another group within that same class. And we look at the revolutions that have taken place, like in Latin America in the main, with the exception of Cuba. But what these revolutions in Latin America, in most of Africa, and South Asia and so forth, we see we're dealing with power changing from the hands of one group into another group, but in no way reorganizing the society. That is not the kind of revolution that I'm referring to, that I'm talking about. The kind of revolution I'm talking about is a very complex historical process that begins with new means of production making the old social order untenable. Because the old social order becomes untenable, old political relations are destroyed, new political relations emerge, and a new society is formed on a new foundation. Now, the last time we saw this happen was with the introduction of the steam engine. The steam engine industrialized an agricultural society, and it made the feudal and slave regimes absolutely impossible. As that clash took place between a new way of production and the old political order that rested upon slave labor and serf labor, we saw new political and economic relations arise, and consequently a whole new society come into being.
Nelson, what makes you believe that revolution is necessary in America today?
Well, certainly we're finding out that America is no longer an island. I want to put this in a world context and try to deal with the question in that sense. And when we look at the world, we see a world where a third of the people of the earth today live on less than a dollar a day. And this is despite the efforts of the United Nations to improve the living conditions of the poorest section of Earth society. I was reading here a few days ago where 5 years ago, 800 million people were starving. And the United Nations worked very hard to try to relieve this sort of a situation. The paper a couple days ago said 800 million people today in the world are starving. So in other words, they haven't been able to develop a way of answering this question of improving the plight of the poor people of the world under the conditions, the economic conditions that exist today. If we look at America in relation to the world, we get a very strange picture. The lowest 20% of the American people live better than 70% of the world's population. And that should tell you that what has happened over the last, especially over the last 30 years, is that like Imperial Rome, right, that the wealth of the world has been dumped on America, so even the poorest in America live considerably better than most people, you know, are in the rest of the world. But the reality of it is that this destruction is beginning to creep in on America as well. Income inequality in America is growing very, very rapidly. When we see the wide accumulation of wealth in one section of society, that is matched with the development and growth of poverty in the other section. All we have to do is look at the healthcare situation in America. It's catastrophic. I mean, it's to the point that even the most reactionary of our senators and congressmen, they recognize they're going to have to do something about healthcare. Because you cannot continue to have a situation where the countries on our border, Mexico and Canada, provide better health care for its citizens than does the United States. A situation where in Texas, for example, people go to Mexico to buy drugs. And along the northern tier of states, Washington, Michigan, New York, so forth, they go to Canada in order to buy prescription drugs. The situation, of course, amongst the elderly is really a criminal thing. What we're seeing is that the whole world being gripped by this new poverty, things are getting worse and nobody's able to do very much about it. This thing isn't the result of bad politicians. I don't know, there's very few politicians that I like there in Washington, but it's not their fault. They have to deal with results the same way that we deal with results. And what they're dealing with is a revolutionary changes that are taking place and how to cope with them. They try to cope with them one way, we try to cope with them in another way.
You mentioned this idea that revolution is necessary, and of course many economic theoreticians can argue that. But more importantly, how is revolution possible?
First of all, I want to say that real revolutions, social revolutions, are not brought about because people want them. That they develop because the social organization no longer fits the economic organization that society rests upon. Capitalism is on the path of self-destruction. Nobody's destroying capitalism. It's destroying itself. The people, the poor people, they have no weapons to destroy the system. System has to destroy itself. And that's going on very, very rapidly throughout the world and certainly in the United States. When we look at this, at the basic struggle that's going on here, it's wage labor against the robot. The robot constantly invading the territory of wage labor. And so how does that threaten the system? Well, this system is based upon buying and selling. That I sell my ability to work, and I buy the things that are produced. The robot means the destruction of wage labor, and that means that you're not able to circulate your production with money. You get money by working, and if there's no work, there's no money. If there's no money, there's no circulation. And eventually, because of this, society goes into revolution. Now, again, I want to really emphasize that no revolutionary ever made a revolution. They only work with them as they develop. And we're at the beginning of such a process in America. I think that no one can deny this.
Peary goes on to say that there's a new class of people being created by the destruction of the capitalist system. These are the people who will push a revolution forward.
History shows us that if you're inside of the economic and social order, you can struggle to get more for yourself or for your class. Or you can struggle to take away what somebody else has. But you can't challenge the system. And I think the upshot of it is if we look at the last great wave of revolutions, that the serfs did not overthrow the nobility, that they fought the nobility, but they always fought for better conditions. You know, they fought to maintain their communal pastures or things like that. But they never were able to fight to overthrow the system because they were a part of it. It's only when an outside force is created that is incompatible with the system that then you have begun talking in terms of revolutionary work. So from this point of view, let's for a moment examine this new class. Now, this class is made up of those who are rendered superfluous by the use of robotics or what we're referred to as electronics. If we look at the class today as it's in the process of formation, we see that at the extreme end of our pole of this class, we see the homeless and the completely destitute. But this goes all the way up and includes those who are in the process of becoming economically marginalized. If we look at the American working class today, it is not the same working class that I belonged to 50 years ago. That today, a third of the workers are what we call throwaway workers, temporary, minimum wage, part-time, workers without health care, without retirement benefits, lacking any sort of economic stability, completely at the mercy of the foreman or the boss that they happen to be temporarily working for. This class is being pushed more and more into a position where it has to eventually attack the system in order to survive. I think most importantly that this class is constantly being reinforced and replenished, not only by workers who are pushed out of the factory by electronics, but also educated, articulate, socially active people that are being pushed out of their jobs, such as middle management jobs and so forth, being pushed out and cannot find work, that they go through this process of, first of all, you know, using up their savings and then selling their stocks and bonds and then finally mortgaging the house and finally finding themselves, you know, in some form of dependency. So we see this new class is a recruit from all sections of society and consequently has, or at least potentially has, the political and intellectual tools to put itself on its feet and begin to the contest for political power in this country.
Now, capitalists may attempt to disguise the economic reality of many poor Americans today. But you mentioned this idea again of the capitalists destroying, in essence, themselves or the system that they've created or that they currently profit from.
Outstanding thinkers, and not just individual thinkers, but these so-called think tanks, have produced and written a number of books in the past 10 to 15 years that discuss this question of what is the inevitable result of these revolutionary means of production invading and disrupting society. One of the opening guns of this of this series of books was Jerry Rifkin's The End of Work, and trying to present to the ruling class, to the elite of America, well, what are we going to do when there's no more work? Because that's what's going to happen. We're heading for a society where there's no work. What are we going to do with the workers? And, of course, he came up with some idea of community services and so forth and so on that doesn't answer the question at all. The rest of these books tend somehow or another to want to create a situation where the workers can participate in the expansion of production, even though they're not working anymore, even though they're not part of the labor process. Anything that they can think of in order to stop the inevitable upsurge, social upsurge, that's going to result from widespread mass unemployment. The capitalists, they don't sit back and say, well, we'd better stop robotics because it's going to overthrow the system. They look and they say, well, look, I got to use robotics in order to outproduce and undersell my competition, even if it destroys me. So the capitalist class, they're caught. They're cutting their own throat and they can't help it. They have to do what they're doing. And what they're doing, of course, is creating the army of unemployed and destitute people that have no choice but to destroy the system and create a system that's based upon these new means of production, but has a different form of distribution. That is to say, that would necessarily distribute according to need rather than distribute according to who has how much money.
Despite the fact that poverty is inescapable in our streets today, people are still reluctant to believe that there's anything better out there than capitalism. Part of this idea comes from the fact that revolutions around the world have oftentimes been televised as being not successful. Can you distinguish for us today's revolution from other revolutions in the past?
Well, I think the major distinction would be that, with the exception of the socialist revolutions that have taken place, that this revolution is by the vast majority in the interest of the vast majority. All other revolutions have been fought out by a section of the elite and only calling into activity that number of people from the masses that are necessary to give them the political and economic and military stability in order to achieve their goals. But this revolution is of the masses and for the masses. Because of globalization, the revolutionary movement, the revolution itself, also has to be global. The former periods of revolution have served to bring democracy into the field of politics. But here we're talking about a revolution that's bound to bring democracy into the field of the economy. Something entirely new, but there is no other way for that revolution to go.
What role do you see women and youth playing in this revolution?
I've had the opportunity to do quite a bit of traveling. And one of the things I'd like to start off saying is that the American woman is the freest woman in the world. There's no question about that. Sometimes we don't think so here in the United States. But they are by far the most free woman. And that is exactly the thing that makes the existing inequality all the more galling and unacceptable to the women of America. The relative freedom of the American woman places them in a position to make even greater contributions to the revolutionary movement. First of all, women constitute the majority of this new class of poor. And that means that movement cannot succeed without actually having women in its leadership. Not the kind of window dressing that we've seen in the past, where women are placed in organizational roles or in roles of support and so forth and so on. I think that they're going to have to really combat the lingering senses of inferiority and uncertainty that's the result of centuries of oppression, and boldly step forward and begin to take their place in the revolutionary movement and making sure that their voices are heard.
You're listening to People's Tribune Radio. Our guest today is Nelson Peary, author of the book Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary, and his newest work, The Future is Up to Us. He was interviewed by Alicia Espinoza in Chicago, Illinois.
You ask about the youth. Well, obviously, the youth, the future belongs to the youth. That's clear. The question that we're faced with is, how do the youth seize that future? What do they do about it? Today, conditions are very, very difficult for the young people. Cuts in education, the lack of jobs, the general lack of direction in the society weighs most heavily, I think, on young people. Because the older people, they already know where they're going or have some idea where they're going. And most of them are already as far as they're going to go anyway. But the young people, they're just starting out and they're adrift. They don't know what to do, where to go, what kind of a person they're supposed to be, what should their values and the morals be. So we have a huge, fertile field for revolutionary activity amongst the young people. I would like to recall, for those of you who are not old enough to remember the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany, that it was the students, above everybody else, it was the students that brought the Nazis to power. That Hitler was able to win over a huge section of the German youth. Of course, the students in Germany were part of the elite, but they were the part that was organized and the part that was had some idea where they were going. So if we allow in America the fascists, the reactionaries, to gain the ear of the youth, to gain the confidence of the youth, that revolutionary movement is lost. So we're talking about something extremely decisive. Now, we should have confidence in the young people, especially the American young people. They're young. That means to say they haven't accumulated a lot of material goods that they have to defend. They don't necessarily identify themselves with a class while they're still young. And so what they perceive from then is morality. The young people are by far the most moral section of the American population. And the only way that we're going to win the youth over is on the basis of that morality, not on the basis of here's how to get rich or anything like that, but here's the right thing to do. And consequently, we see that spontaneously in the United States, there is a huge anarchist movement that includes the hip-hop movement and all up and down the line. There's millions and millions of young people that are expressing their rebelliousness and their demand for change in music, in the arts, in the dance, and so forth. So, yes, we have to get out among these young people and win them over to the morality of the revolution, because they have no other future outside of that. Today, as in the Depression years, young people fight for visions rather than for material possessions. We were speaking about the Hitler Youth Movement, for example. Hitler was able to present to them a vision of a Germany that won at least a certain section of that youth movement over. And I think that we in America today, we are going to have to learn this lesson, and we're going to have to present to the American youth a vision of an America that they can live in, a vision that they can participate in social and political life of this country. Because without that vision, I don't believe that the young people can be won over to the revolution. I want to make a distinction between daydreaming and visions, you know, that you can daydream about anything. You don't have to have a material base to do so. But if you're talking in terms of a vision, then you're talking in terms of facts. You know, you're talking in terms of possibilities, that visions arise from facts. And the fact of it is that America is a huge continent-sized nation that's still in formation, but still can produce enough to feed the entire world. I think World War II proved that we have the productive capacity to create the material necessities for almost the entire world. I mean, this is a tremendously rich country. It's from this fact of the huge size of the country, the wealth of the country, the productive capacity of the country, and the potential of robots and electronic production that we make our vision. And that vision essentially is a new epoch of intellectual and cultural development. We're talking about a world of plenty, which means a world of peace, because every war that's ever been fought has been fought over the allocation of scarcity. We have the ability today to do away with scarcity. So we're talking about a new epic in the development of human beings, without war, without stress, without fear, without hunger. the doors open to the cultural and intellectual development of the entire human race. We think in terms of security for the children, for our future. We're talking in terms of friendship with our neighbors because we don't have anything to fight about. I mean, nobody's going to steal your battery. Nobody's going to hold you up at night. Nobody's going to threaten your well-being because there's no material gain in it. And so we're talking about the possibility of really creating economic and social paradise on Earth here if we just use the existing means of production in that direction. People are talking about love and happiness and all this sort of thing. That's fine. These are goals. But the goal of the revolutionary is to create the conditions where love and happiness and peace is possible. We can't make the people happy. We can only help them create the conditions where they can be happy. This is the decisive role, it seems to me, of revolutionaries in this period. We're entering a new epoch. And because we're entering a new epoch, I think the thing that needs to be done is a lot of discussing, a lot of studying, a lot of trying, a lot of debating. I think that the American people are so used to having the government, you know, provide the direction. And that direction generally has meant a development or an increase in their material well-being, that they've lost the thing that we had back during the 30s and 40s of debating issues and feeling passionate about things. That if there's anything the American people need to do, they need to come together and start talking about where America is heading. They need to start organizing themselves to guarantee that this country becomes the kind of country that it can and should be. A very difficult time, I believe, lies ahead for the American people. But they can see themselves through this time if they have some confidence in themselves, if they begin to develop their own leaders, begin to have confidence in themselves as American citizens. What is the basis of all of the strife and hatreds and struggle in America, you know, amongst the American people? They're fighting over scarcity. They're fighting, how do we divide scarcity? Either I get it or you don't get it. You know, and so the first thing to do is that if we can imagine a nation without scarcity, where there is plenty for all, and everybody in America, I think, has an understanding that given the means of production that are already on hand, and given the productive capacity of the American worker, that there's the possibility of plenty is there. And once that happens, once we no longer have to struggle over the division of scarcity, we can love one another. We can dance and laugh and smile and greet one another in the morning, you know, but we got to get rid of the competition. And this idea that competitiveness is what drives America forward, no, it's the competitiveness that brings out the beast in human beings. And I just, when you asked me to describe what kind of America I envision, it's first of all an America without the struggle to control scarcity. An America that's concerned with the division of abundance and guaranteeing that everybody in America has the access to a wholesome life. That this is not a dream. This is possible. We have to fight for it.
Nelson Peary, author of Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary, and his newest book, The Future is Up to Us. He was interviewed by Alicia Espinoza in Chicago, Illinois. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society with social and economic justice for all. If you'd like more information about the League or our other print or audio publications, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888, 1-800-691-6888, or on the Internet at www.lrna.org. My name is Mike Thornton, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.